Even though Zapfe regarded psychoanalysis as another form of anchoring, whether or not a repressional mechanism is accessible to our consciousness or is wholly unconscious seems a trivial point. For both Smith and Zapfe, they lead to the same thing, occlusion of the real. Another thing Smith and Zapfe share is that their ideas about humankind are not scientifically verifiable and will not be for some time to come, if ever. And, without proof on a platter, anyone whose ideas are unpalatable to scientists, philosophers, and average mortals must expect to be poorly heard. Smith does not seem to understand this, and in the closing pages of his book expresses hope that humanity will one day get real, as the saying goes. At the end of The Last Messiah, Zapfe expressed an unconditional pessimism that this could ever happen, which was patently the only reasonable attitude for him to take. Smith himself might consider getting real about his hope we will ever get real, given that humanity will always have its reasons for being repressed, self-deceptive, and unreal. A utopia in which we no longer deny the realities we presently must repress cannot be realistically hoped for. And who, except a pessimist, would wish for that utopia? The effectiveness of conscious repressional mechanisms has been analyzed from many angles, particularly in relation to the fear of death. An enumeration of traditional strategies for grappling with thanatophobia appears in Choices for Living, Coping with the Fear of Dying by Thomas S. Langer. Although the subtitle of this book suggests that it concentrates on the fear of dying, it is more about the fear of death, not about the suffering and terror that may attend either a short-lived or a dawdling migration into death. Factually, Langer's book, like many others of its kind, is fixated on living rather than on either death or dying, which seem to be only blurry contingencies while an individual is alive. Doctor, I'm afraid you have an inoperable tumor and haven't long to live. Patient, that can't be. I feel in perfect health. Police officer, I'm sorry to inform you, ma'am, that your husband has been involved in a vehicular misadventure. He's dead. Wife, that can't be. He just left the house 10 minutes ago. Given a little time, of course, the cancer patient and the woman who just lost her husband come around to their respective realities. Acceptance of one's new condition, as opposed to going mad or reacting in some other pathological manner, seems to be the usual process, on the condition, naturally, that an individual lives long enough to accept it and does not die of an inoperable tumor first. In the media and all forms of entertainment, such bad breaks are exposed to us all our lives. But we still do not heed the old saw, hope for the best, but expect the worst. Instead, we hope for the best, and think we have a very good chance of getting it. If we really expected the worst, we might well go mad or react in some other pathological manner before the worst came for us and ours. And that really would be the worst. Suffering 1. For almost all philosophers who write about death, the subject is studied in the abstract, with the unsightly tangibles at its bedside either bracketed or shrugged off. If dying is even given the time of day by philosophers, it must be studied as a subcategory of suffering, the meaning of, which few thinkers discuss outside of moral philosophy and ethics, relatively soft cognitive pastimes when placed beside logic, epistemology, ontology, etc. Philosophies that take human suffering as their overarching subject are given short shrift by analytic types who leave suffering, the meaning of, to religions such as Buddhism and Christianity, or to pessimists. Unless a philosopher is prepared to go all the way with it, to take a hard line on its relevance to the whole of human life, as did Schopenhauer and a few other relics of the pre-modern era, he will balk at saying anything about suffering. One who did not balk entirely was the Austrian-born British philosopher Karl Popper, who in The Open Society and Its Enemies did have a thing or two to say about human suffering. Briefly, he revamped the utilitarianism of the 19th-century British philosopher John Stuart Mill, who wrote, "Actions are right in proportion as they tend to promote happiness, wrong as they tend to promote the reverse of happiness." Popper remolded this summation of a positive utilitarianism into a negative utilitarianism, whose position he handily stated as follows: "It adds to clarity in the fields of ethics if we formulate our demands negatively, that is, if we demand the elimination of suffering rather than the promotion of happiness." Taken to its logical and most humanitarian conclusion, Popper's demand can have as its only end the elimination of those who now suffer, as well as counterfactual beings who will suffer if they are born. What else could the elimination of suffering mean, if not its total abolition and ours? Naturally, Popper held his horses well before suggesting that to eliminate suffering would demand that we as a species be eliminated. But, as R.N. Smart famously argued, this is the only conclusion to be drawn from negative utilitarianism. In The Last Messiah, Zapfe is not sanguine about eliminating suffering, nor is he so unworldly as to beseech a communal solution for its elimination by snuffing out the human race, as did the Catharai and the Bugamiles. He does lash out at the barbarism of social or religious prescription of suicide, but he is not a standard-bearer for this form of personal salvation. To reiterate with due compunction, Zapfe's thought is foremost an addendum to that of various sects and individuals who have resolved that conscious existence is so odious that extinction is preferable to survival. It also has the value of advancing a new answer to an old question. Why should generations unborn be spared entry into the human thresher? But what might be called Zapfe's paradox, in the tradition of possessively named formulations that saturate primers of philosophy, is as useless as the propositions of any other thinker who is pro-life or anti-life, or is only juggling concepts to clinch what is reality and can we ever get there. That said, we can continue as if it had not been said. The measure of a philosopher's thought is not in its answers or the problems it poses, but in how well it fiddles with these answers and problems such that they animate the minds of others. Thus, the importance and the nullity of rhetoric. Ask any hard-line pessimist, but do not expect him to expect you to take his words seriously. Suffering 2. Perhaps the greatest strike against philosophical pessimism is that its only theme is human suffering. This is the last item on the list of our species' obsessions and detracts from everything that matters to us, such as the good, the beautiful, and a sparkling clean toilet bowl. For the pessimist, everything considered in isolation from human suffering or any cognition that does not have as its motive the origins, nature, and elimination of human suffering is at base recreational, whether it takes the form of conceptual probing or physical action in the world, for example, delving into game theory or traveling in outer space, respectively. And by human suffering, the pessimist is not thinking of particular sufferings and their relief, but with suffering itself. Remedies may be discovered for certain diseases, and socio-political barbarities may be amended, but these are only stopgaps. Human suffering will remain insoluble as long as human beings exist. The one truly effective solution for suffering is that spoken of in Zapfe's The Last Messiah. It may not be a welcome solution for a stopgap world, but it would forever put an end to suffering, should we ever care to do so. The pessimist's credo, or one of them, is that non-existence never hurt anyone, and existence hurts everyone. Although ourselves may be illusory creations of consciousness, our pain is nonetheless real. As a survival-happy species, Our successes are calculated in the number of years we have extended our lives, with the reduction of suffering being only incidental to this aim. To stay alive under almost any circumstances is a sickness with us. Nothing could be more unhealthy than to watch one's health as a means of stalling death. The lengths we will go as procrastinators of that last gasp only demonstrate a morbid dread of that event. By contrast, our fear of suffering is deficient. So Shakespeare's Edgar, when he passes on the wisdom that the worst is not, so long as we can say this is the worst. Officially, there are no fates worse than death. Unofficially, there is a profusion of such fates. For some people, just living with the thought that they will die is a fate worse than death itself. Longevity is, without question, of paramount value in our lives, and finding a corrective for mortality is our compulsive project. Anything goes insofar as lengthening our earthly tenure. And how we have cashed in on our efforts. No need to cram our lives into 2 or 3 decades, now that we can cram them into 7, 8, 9, or more. The lifespan of non-domesticated mammals has never changed, while ours has grown by leaps and bounds. What a coup for the human race! Unaware how long they will live, other warm-blooded life forms are sluggards by comparison. Time will run out for us, as it does for all creatures, true, but at least we can dream of a day when we might elect our own deadline. Then perhaps we can all die of the same thing, a killing satiation with our durability in a world that is malignantly useless. Worthless, rather than useless, is the more familiar epithet in this context. The rationale for using useless in place of worthless in this histrionically capitalized phrase is that worthless is tied to the concepts of desirability and value, and by their depreciation introduces them into the existential mix. Useless, on the other hand, is not so inviting of these concepts. Elsewhere in this work, worthless is connected to the language of pessimism and does what damage it can. But the devil of it is that worthless really does not go far enough when speaking pessimistically about the character of existence. Too many times the question, "Is life worth living?" has been asked. This usage of worth excites impressions of a fair lot of experiences that are arguably desirable and valuable within limits, and that may follow upon one another in such a way as to suggest that life is not totally worthless. With useless, the wispy spirits of desirability and value do not as readily rear their heads. Naturally, the uselessness of all that is or could ever be is subject to the same repudiations as the worthlessness of all that is or could ever be. For this reason, the adverb malignantly has been annexed to useless, to give it a little more semantic stretch and a dose of toxicity. But to express with any adequacy a sense of the uselessness of everything, a non-linguistic modality would be needed, some effusion out of a dream that amalgamated every gradation of the useless and wordlessly transmitted to us the inanity of existence under any possible conditions. Indigent of such means of communication, the uselessness of all that exists or could possibly exist must be spoken with a poor potency. Not unexpectedly, no one believes that everything is useless, and with good reason. We all live within relative frameworks, and within those frameworks uselessness is far wide of the norm. A potato masher is not useless if one wants to mash potatoes. For some people, a system of being that includes an afterlife of eternal bliss may not seem useless. They might say that such a system is absolutely useful because it gives them the hope they need to make it through this life. But an afterlife of eternal bliss is not and cannot be absolutely useful simply because you need it to be. It is part of a relative framework, and nothing beyond that, just as a potato masher is only part of a relative framework and is useful only if you need to mash potatoes. Once you had made it through this life to an afterlife of eternal bliss, you would have no use for that afterlife. Its job would be done, and all you would have is an afterlife of eternal bliss, a paradise for reverent hedonists and pious libertines. What is the use in that? You might as well not exist at all, either in this life or in an afterlife of eternal bliss. Any kind of existence is useless. Nothing is self-justifying. Everything is justified only in a relativistic potato-masher sense. There are some people who do not get up in arms about potato-masher relativism, while other people do. The latter want to think in terms of absolutes that are really absolute and not just absolute potato-mashers. Christians, Jews, and Muslims have a real problem with a potato-masher system of being. Buddhists have no problem with a potato-masher system because, for them, there are no absolutes. What they need to realize is the truth of dependent origination, which means that everything is related to everything else in a great network of potato-mashers that are always interacting with one another. So the only problem Buddhists have is not being able to realize that the only absolutely useful thing is the realization that everything is a great network of potato-mashers. They think that if they can get over this hump, they will be eternally liberated from suffering. At least, they hope they will, which is all they really need to make it through this life. In the Buddhist faith, everyone suffers who cannot see that the world is a malignantly useless potato-mashing network. However, that does not make Buddhists superior to Christians, Jews, and Muslims. It only means they have a different system for making it through a life where all we can do is wait for musty shadows to call our names when they are ready for us. After that happens, there will be nobody who will need anything that is not absolutely useless. Ask any atheist. Ecocide. Despite Zapfe's work as a philosopher, although not in an occupational role, he earned his living by writing poems, plays, stories, and humorous pieces, he is better known as an early ecologist who popularized the term biosophy to name a discipline that would broaden the compass of philosophy to include the interests of other living things besides human beings. In this capacity, he serves as an inspiration to environmentalists who worry about the well-being of the earth and its organisms. Here, too, we catch ourselves, and Zapfe himself, as he affirmed, in the act of conspiring to build barricades against the repugnant facts of life by signing on to a cause, in this case that of environmentalism, that snubs the real issue. Vandalism of the environment is but a sidebar to humanity's refusal to look into the jaws of existence. In truth, we have only one foot in the natural environment of this world. Other worlds are always calling us away from nature. We live in a habitat of unrealities, not of earth, air, water, and wildlife, and cradling illusion trounces grim logic every time. Some of the more combative environmentalists, however, have concurred with Zapfe that we should retire from existence, but their advocacy of worldwide suicide as a strategy for saving the earth from being pillaged by human beings receives no mention in The Last Messiah, and was probably not on Zapfe's mind when he wrote this essay. As appealing as a universal suicide pact may be, why take part in it just to conserve this planet, this dim bulb in the blackness of space? Nature produced us, or at least subsidized our evolution. It intruded on an inorganic wasteland and set up shop. What evolved was a global workhouse where nothing is ever at rest, where the generation and discarding of life incessantly goes on. By what virtue, then, is it entitled to receive a pardon for this original sin, a capital crime in reverse, just as reproduction makes one an accessory before the fact to an individual's death? In its course, nature has made blunders in plenty. These are left to die out, as is nature's wont. Perhaps this will be how we will go, a natural death. It might be idly theorized, though, that nature has a special plan for human beings, and devised us to serve as a way of revoking itself, much like Mineland's self-expunging god. An offbeat idea, no protest, but not the strangest we have ever heard or lived by. We could at least take up the hypothesis and see where it leads. If it is proved unviable, then where is the harm? But until then, might we not let ourselves be drawn along by nature's plan, which includes our sacking the earth as a paradoxical means of living better in it, or at least living as our nature bids us to live? We did not make ourselves, nor did we fashion a world that could not work without pain, and great pain at that, with a little pleasure, very little, to string us along, a world where all organisms are inexorably pushed by pain throughout their lives to do that which will improve their chances to survive and create more of themselves. Left unchecked, this process will last as long as a single cell remains palpitating in this cesspool of the solar system, this toilet of the galaxy. So why not lend a hand in nature's suicide? For want of a deity that could be held to account for a world in which there is terrible pain, let nature take the blame for our troubles. We did not create an environment uncongenial to our species. Nature did. One would think that nature was trying to kill us off, or get us to suicide ourselves once the blunder of consciousness came upon us. What was nature thinking? We tried to anthropomorphize it, to romanticize it, to let it into our hearts. But nature kept its distance, leaving us to our own devices. So be it. Survival is a two-way street. Once we settle ourselves off-world, we can blow up this planet from outer space. It's the only way to be sure its stench will not follow us. Let it save itself, if it can. The condemned are known for the acrobatics they will execute to wriggle out of their sentences. But if it cannot destroy what it has made, and what could possibly unmake it, then may it perish along with every other living thing it has introduced to pain. While no species has given in to pain to the point of giving up its existence, so far as we know, it is not a phenomenon whose praises are often sung. Hopelessness. In Zapfa's The Last Messiah, the titular figure appears at the end and makes the mock-Socratic, biblically parodic pronouncement, "Know yourselves, be infertile, and let the earth be silent after ye," Zapfa's emphasis. As Zapfa pictures the scene, the last Messiah's words will not be well received. And when he has spoken, they will pour themselves over him, led by the pacifier makers and the midwives, and bury him in their fingernails. Semantically speaking, the last Messiah is not a Messiah, since he saves no living soul and will be erased from human memory by a vigilante group whose kingpins are the pacifier makers and the midwives. Moreover, a resurrection seems to be the last thing in the last Messiah's future. To exposit why humanity should not further tarry on earth is one thing. To believe that this proposition will be agreeable to others is quite another. Due to the note of hopelessness in the coda to Zapfa's essay, we are discouraged from imagining a world in which the self-liquidation of humanity could ever be put into effect. The Norwegian himself did not take the trouble to do so in The Last Messiah. No reason he should, since he would first have to imagine a new humanity, which is not as a practice done outside of fiction, a medium of realism but not of reality. Yet, these new humans would not have to be super-involved or otherwise freakish organisms living far in the future. They would only have to be like Zapfa in recognizing that a retreat from the worldly scene would be a benevolent proceeding for the good of the unborn. Becoming extinct would seem to be a tall order, but not one that would be insurmountably time-consuming. Zapfe optimistically projected that those of the new humanity could be evacuated from existence over the course of a few generations, and indeed they could. As their numbers tapered off, these dead-enders of our species could be the most privileged individuals in history and share with one another material comforts once held in trust only for the well-born or money-getting classes of the world. Since personal economic gain would be passé as a motive for the new humanity, there would be only one defensible incitement to work, to see one another through to the finish, a project that would keep everyone busy and not just staring into space while they waited for the end. There might even be bright smiles exchanged among these selfless benefactors of those who would never be forced to exist. And how many would speed up the process of extinction once euthanasia was decriminalized and offered in humane and even enjoyable ways? What a relief, what an unburdening to have closed the book on humankind. Yet it would not need to be slammed shut. As long as we progressed toward a thinning of the herd, couples could still introduce new faces into the human fold as billions became millions and then thousands. New generations would learn about the past and, like those before them, feel lucky not to have been born in times of fewer conveniences and cures, although they might still play at cowboys and Indians, cops and robbers, management and labor. The last of us could be the very best of us who ever roamed the earth, the great exemplars of a humanity we used to dream of becoming, before we got wise to the reality that we are just a mob always in the market for new recruits. Quite naturally, this depiction of an end times by an extinctionist covenant will seem abhorrent to those now living in hope of a better future, not necessarily one in which glorious progress has been made toward the alleviation of human misery, but at least one that will partially exculpate them from a depraved indifference to the harm predestined for their young. It may also seem a romanticized utopia, since those who predict major readjustments in humanity's self-conception, Karl Marx et al., often believe that a revolution in ethics will blossom when their truths are instituted. Worse, or perhaps better, if the solution to human suffering is to be final, the idea of a new humanity may be a smokescreen for a tyrannical oligarchy run by militants of extinction rather than a social and psychological sanctuary for a species harboring the universal goal of delimiting its stay on Earth. If Zapfe uselessly exercised himself by formulating the thesis of The Last Messiah, he was sharp enough to give it a hopeless finale. Without an iota of uncertainty, humankind is and will always be unsuited to take charge of its own deliverance. The delusional will forever be with us, thereby making pain, fear, and denial of what is right in front of our face the preferred style of living, and the one that will be passed on to countless generations. The reception of the research of a Canadian scientist named Michael Persinger may be seen as an indication of humanity's genius for keeping itself locked into its old ways. In the 1980s, Persinger modified a motorcycle helmet to affect the magnetic fields of the brain of its wearer, inducing a variety of strange sensations. These included experiences in which subjects felt themselves proximate to supernatural phenomena that included ghosts and gods. Atheists used Persinger's studies to nail closed their argument for the subjectivity of anyone's sense of the supernatural. Not to be left behind, believers wrote their own books in which they contended that the magnetic field-emitting motorcycle helmet proved the existence of a god that hardwired itself into our brains. A field of study called neurotheology grew up around this and other laboratory experiments. Even if you can prop up a scientific theory with a cudgel of data that should render the holy opposition unconscious, they will be standing ready to discredit you, imprisonment, torture, and public execution having gone the way of chastity belts. For writers of supernatural horror, The perquisite of this deadlock is that it ensures the larger part of humanity will remain in a state of fear, because no one can ever be certain of either his own ontological status or that of gods, demons, alien invaders, and sundry other bugbears. A Buddhist would advise that we forget about whether or not the boogeymen we have invented or divined are real. The big question is this: are we real? Debatability. Even though Zapffe's theory is perceptible in our lives, we do not actually have any sense, or any strong sense, that human beings are false and paradoxical beings, at least not yet. And if we did, why would that mean we should go extinct and not continue to live as we have all these years? One would think that neuroscientists and geneticists would have as much reason to head for the cliffs, because little by little they have been finding that much of our thought and behavior is attributable to neural wiring and heredity, rather than to personal control over the individuals we are, or think we are. But they do not feel suicide to be mandatory just because their laboratory experiments are informing them that human nature may be nothing but puppet nature. Not the slightest tingle of uncanniness or horror runs up and down their spines, only the thrill of discovery. Most of them reproduce and do not believe there is anything questionable in doing so. If they could get a corpse to sit up on an operating table, they would jubilantly exclaim, "It's alive!" And so would we. Who cares that human beings evolved from slimy materials? We can live with that, or most of us can. Actually, we can probably live with any conception of ourselves for quite a while longer. Although we may have phases in which the power of positive thinking peters out, no scientific discoveries or anything else can get to us for long, at least not as far as we can see into the future. As a species with consciousness, we do have our inconveniences. Yet these are of negligible importance compared to what it would be like to feel in our depths that we are nothing but human puppets, things of mistaken identity who must live with the terrible knowledge that they are not making a go of it on their own and are not what they once thought they were. At this time, barely anyone can conceive of this happening, of hitting bottom and finding to our despair that we can never again resurrect our repressions and denials. Not until that day of lost illusions comes, if it ever comes, will we all be competent to conceive of such a thing. But a great many more generations will pass through life before that happens, if it happens.